Mr. DeMille. I'm ready for my close-up.
I'll show up sometime. See me.
Aiden Bond! Top of the world!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night, sir.
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hi, Wendy here. Before we start off our episode today, I want to remind everybody to check us out on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. Also, please leave a rating or comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can find us on social media by simply searching Silver Screen Time Machine, and please make sure you follow our podcast, Silver Screen Time Machine, anywhere you get your podcast. Thank you, and enjoy the episode. Hello, this is Wendy from Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review. And today I have a guest, Mary Beth. Hello, Mary Beth.
Hello.
So excited to have you here. Before we go into the film, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Anything you'd like to share with us?
Well, I'll start back at childhood. My love of Audrey Hepburn started with actually a different movie, My Fair Lady.
Yes.
And despite its extended runtime, my sister and I watched and rewatched the heck out of that movie. I actually didn't watch Breakfast at Tiffany's until high school. But at this point, I would say I've seen the majority of her films, just been a lifelong fan of her. So I wanted to definitely pick the most iconic role that she's known for to talk about today.
Yeah, awesome. And a little bit about yourself. I know, as much as I know about you, I know that you run marathons. I know that much.
Yeah.
Are you in a band also?
I keep busy. I have many hobbies. I'm training for the Philly Marathon right now. And my band is playing at Brillo Box actually this Friday.
Yeah, awesome. I have to come see your band sometime. And you were just recently engaged. Congratulations. Yes.
Well, we can see this in the video. Actually, what's funny is when...
Is it a turquoise?
It's a topaz. When Sean was on here, it was literally one day before he proposed, night before it all happened.
He proposed on my birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yep. We're talking about Sean Collier, who was on for Bride of Frankenstein. But anyhow, so yeah, sometime I'm going to have to come and see your band. Mm-hmm. But we are getting in our time machine, and we are going back to 1961, and we are talking about the wonderful, iconic film, Breakfast at Tiffany's. Breakfast at Tiffany's. So this film was nominated for a couple Oscars, Best Actress for Audrey, Best Screenplay for George Axelrod, and Best Art Direction. And of course, it won for Best Score and Best Original Song, Moon River, by Henry Mancini. I guess Moon River also was written by Johnny Mercer, Johnny Mercer and Henry Mancini. Well deserved on the score. I love the score.
I know, and at that time, people were not buying movie soundtracks, but this was a best-selling album, the soundtrack from this film.
And Andy Williams had a popular hit with Moon River. He would eventually sing Moon River himself, and it was a very big popular hit. It's really a very beautiful song.
It really is. Yeah, Andy Williams, that ended up being the song he was known for. He did sing it at the Oscars. And back to me being in a band, my band in high school played a punk rock cover of Moon River for the talent show.
Oh, that's awesome. That's actually very cool. I would love to hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I have to say, Henry Mancini, he's known for a lot of films. He's excellent. He collaborated frequently with our director, who is Blake Edwards. Well, he's a four-time Oscar winner, these two Oscars, plus For the Days of Wine and Roses, if you've seen that. That's an excellent film.
I still need to see it, but they did mention it in the book that I read about the film.
Yeah, not your usual Blake Edwards type film. That's a beautifully done film. And Victoria, he won also for that. And I think most people know him for The Pink Panther. That's his most famous theme. And the thing I thought was most interesting about Henry Mancini is he's Pittsburgh
boy. Yeah, in the Mancini's bread family, that's his family.
Yeah, it's awesome. He's from Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
So he had 18 Oscar nominations. He's a great famous score writer. And I just really love what he did with the score here. And this film is based on a novella by Truman Capote. They had to make a lot of changes.
Well, mainly I did read the novella when I was in high school just for fun, sitting
on my salacious
parents' back porch. I don't recall it being especially salacious, but I might not have picked up on all the subtleties. But basically, it's very short and it's more of a character study. So in order to make any sort of movie about it, they had to add a plot. That was Axelrod's goal, was to add plot.
Yeah. I thought George Axelrod did a really nice job in this. Again, he was Oscar nominated for this. He also wrote the screenplay for 7 Year Itch and Paris When It Sizzles, which is another Audrey movie.
Seen
and also, which I think is most interesting, The Manchurian Candidate, which is a much different kind of film than this.
Right. So back to Axelrod, he actually wrote the play version of The 7 Year Itch.
Did he?
And had to adapt it for film during the time of Code. So all of the imagined adultery in The 7 Year Itch was actually portrayed as reality in the, play version. And I don't think Axelrod was really happy with having to work around the code in that way.
Yeah, I don't think anybody was.
After that, he kind of got typecast as writing, kind of like for bimbos, I guess. That's at least the impression I got from this Fifth Avenue 5 AM by Sam Wasson. So he was really excited. He wanted to write a classy rom-com, which he got to do for Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah, and like I said, to go from Breakfast at Tiffany's to The Manchurian Candidate, I mean, you can't really go two more different kind of films.
Exactly.
It is something that Truman Capote had wanted Marilyn, you know, in the role of Holly Golightly. He kind of had her in mind from the very beginning for that role. She was asked, but she turned it down because Lee Strasberger told her she shouldn't.
Shouldn't play a call girl.
Yeah, but instead she did The Misfits, which of course is... Yeah, definitely a different kind of film than Breakfast at Tiffany. But considering the success of Breakfast at Tiffany's, you wonder, would that have been a better role for her? Or was the success due to Audrey Hepburn?
Well, the way actually that Holly Golightly is described in the book, she's described as being very thin and very like exactly what Audrey Hepburn looks like.
Yeah.
So it's odd to me that Truman didn't see Audrey in that role.
I think because she has been so goody-goody
princess
in most of her roles.
Yes.
Yeah, she was like this untouchable sort of thing, and I think that's why he couldn't imagine that. He said he based Holly Golightly on a lady named Carol Grace. She was the former wife of William Saroyan. I can't say his name. Is that what's his name? His author. He's an author. But anyhow, and she was also the future wife of Walter Matthau, and she had been a friend of his while living in New York, and he said that's who he based the character on.
I think, too, it was a little bit based on his own mother.
Oh, yeah.
Truman Capote's mother's real name was Lily May and changed it to Nina. Not too much different from Lula May being changed to Holly. And much like Holly kind of came from humble Southern beginnings and tried to hide who she truly was by hanging out with men in higher social circles.
Ah, interesting. That's an interesting insight. I guess maybe he couldn't say it was his mother. He didn't want to like make people think his mother was a call girl. I don't
know.
Yeah, so maybe that was part of the problem. But you know what else I thought was kind of amusing was that when Truman Capote first pitched the idea, or he was asked about selling the rights to the novella, he had asked to play Paul.
He did,
like,
yes.
Can you imagine?
And the producer, Shepherd and Juro, had to be like, you know what? You're too good for this role. You're too above this role. They kind of had to butter him up to turn him down.
We're going to go in a different direction altogether. A much more handsome, tall actor. No, just kidding. Yeah, Truman Capote, I cannot even envision that. That is so strange. Yeah, so anyhow, Blake Edwards was not the first director of this film.
Mm-mm.
He was the second director. This film was originally directed by John Frankenheimer. There's a lot of weird connections with The Manchurian Candidate here because John Frankenheimer is somebody who, he was the director of The Manchurian Candidate, but it's said that Audrey kind of ousted him.
Audrey
said, I don't know who this guy is.
Wanted to work with I think the original director was more known for television. He really hadn't established himself yet. And Audrey wanted to work with a more established director. And this is a term they didn't use back then, but we use now. Audrey had a little bit of imposter syndrome about her acting abilities. So she relied upon the directors to really shape her performance.
Oh, I agree. And she also would get people she felt very comfortable with, and she would like to use them a lot. Not that she used Blake Edwards, but when you look at her career, she went with a lot of the same directors.
Stanley Donen.
Yeah, William Wyler. Yeah, she would always repeatedly repeatedly mm-hmm. have these same directors because they made her feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. So she was somebody that if that was in her comfort zone, she would want to have those people around. Although I really don't think Blake Edwards was that much more established. He was kind of famous for his own TV show, Peter Gunn.
And Operation Petticoat. The producers were impressed that they could handle Cary Grant. I guess I didn't know this, but I guess maybe he was hard to work with. So they're like, he can handle Cary Grant.
Cary Grant can handle
Audrey, because they knew she wasn't difficult, but that she needed
extra a lot of reassurance mm-hmm. and stuff. Yeah, she was kind of insecure in a way. For somebody as beautiful as mm-hmm. Audrey was, she could be very insecure, especially about the way she was shot. So hence the cinematographer, mm-hmm. Franz Plauner, I pray I say that right. He was a frequent cinematographer with Audrey. He worked with her in Roman Holiday, The Unforgiven, The Children's Hour, and A Nun's Story. And he was also nominated for 5 Oscars. So she really felt comfortable with him. And I like what he did, the cinematographer. He did a lot of overhead shots. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you noticed. I really love particularly that one scene with her after she finds out about Fred and she gets really upset. And they just show her in the bed and you see all these like feathers falling down. I thought that was a really beautifully done scene, the way he has an overhead shot of that.
He also did an overhead shot while they were in Tiffany's, which was extremely difficult.
Yes.
But seeing the aftermath of her finding out about Fred is so heartbreaking, because you're rooting for her as a character to be reunited.
Reunited. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you absolutely are. The whole time you're sort of given mm-hmm. that thought that that's going to happen at some point. Yeah, you expect it. And he did a lot of some deep focus shots, I noticed. There was a shot at one point where there's a focus, the cat is sitting in the window and you see the cat real close up. And through the window, you can see Audrey and George coming up the street in the distance. And that's kind of a deep focus technique that was sort of made famous in Citizen Kane. Let's start talking a little bit about the plot. Mm-hmm. So the movie starts off at Tiffany's, and I believe all the exteriors were shot on location mm-hmm. in New York. The interiors, however, were almost all shot in a studio. So sort of see her going up the stairs to her apartment. That's in New York, but when she gets into the apartment, she's actually in the studio. So the art direction, the set design, these fellows were nominated for Academy Awards. Hal Pereira and Roland Anderson, they were responsible for creating all these sort of indoor sets. Especially, I thought, was most notable when they recreated the inside of Tiffany's, because they do have her at Tiffany's at first, but then as she's going further into the scene, that's another set that they created. Mm-hmm. So they did a really good job of mirroring that, and the New York Public Library, 2 sets I thought they did a really good job with that they built. So in the beginning, she's just standing there looking into Tiffany. She's eating her little Danish, which apparently she hated. And apparently it took a really long time to get the shot, because they were actually in New York City and there was mm-hmm. supposedly a crowd of people gathered around. And she was a shy person, and it made her anxious to have all those people there. And then she had to eat the Danish, which she didn't. First of all, she had an eating issue to begin with. She didn't like Danishes, and she was having a lot of trouble getting the shot. And then apparently one of the crew members almost got electrocuted. And Audrey's such a compassionate person mm-hmm. that she's like, somebody's in danger. I need to stop worrying about myself and get the shot done.
And she had 2 dresses for that scene too, because the standing, eating the Danish dress, looking in the window was too tight to walk in. So getting out of the taxi was another dress with slit.
Oh, I didn't even know that. And of course, her dress is from Givenchy. Mm-hmm. She's known, again, a person she's very comfortable with.
Yes.
Givenchy always dressed her, I think, from maybe Sabrina on. I think she met him in Sabrina.
Yes, it started with Sabrina because, again, working around the code, they had to show that she'd become more worldly.
Paris.
The idea was they had to show, without her having sex, that she was more of a woman. So they did it through her wardrobe.
Yeah.
And Givenchy, I was surprised to learn, was only 2 years older than her. He was also very young when they started working together.
Yeah, they were contemporaries. Mm-hmm. They were actually friends mm-hmm. and contemporaries. But Givenchy wasn't nominated for an Academy Award for this. But this is some of the most iconic fashion of any of her films. And this is sort of what started the little black dress trend. Mm-hmm. So, you probably could have given him a nod.
Yeah, and Edith Head did do some
she
of
did
the...
do some, yeah.
Designs. She did the raincoat.
Oh, did she?
She wasn't too fond of the relationship with Givenchy.
I wonder, did she design, I don't know, do you know, did she design Patricia Neal's? Because that looks more Edith Head to me.
than Givenchy.
I think so. I think only Audrey got the Givenchy.
That's what I thought, because when I saw the way Patricia Neal is dressed, she's dressed very classy throughout the film. It just looked to me more Edith Head, but I wasn't sure. I didn't actually research that part. So we're back to the plot. Yeah, it was so easy to get off track.
I know.
Yeah, so anyhow, next thing we see, she's going into her apartment. Now, here we're going to come to what is seriously the biggest flaw in this film, and a blight on the film, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's a bad mark on this film, is you have Mickey Rooney playing this Japanese character. It is so bad. It is so bad. It's bad enough to have a white person playing a Japanese role to begin with, but it's played in such a horribly stereotypic way. Those teeth they had,
I know,
it's
it really ruins the film.
It and ruins it.
The reason he's in it, Blake Edwards. They were buddies. They used to be roommates.
We couldn't find another part somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there couldn't be some other part.
Sometimes looking upon older films, you could be like, well, it was a different time, but no, even in this time,
this is 60s,
it was... In poor taste. It was offensive.
Yeah, we're not in 1930. We're in 1960. By now, we should have learned that this is not what we do. So, unfortunately, there's nothing that can be done about it. It's a part of the film, but it is a terrible thing. But so she comes to the apartment, and this is the thing. She's always bugging this poor Mr. What is his name?
Yuniashi.
Mr. Yuniashi. She's always bugging him because she never has her key. So she's always buzzing him, and she's coming in at these unreasonable hours in the morning, waking him up, and he's really upset, and he gets her in the apartment, blah, blah, blah. She has this man that's like waiting for her and stalking her. She gets stalked a lot in this film by these random men that are giving her money and then expect something from her. I think we all know how that goes, but
honestly, that was right over my head when I watched it when I was younger.
Oh, when you were younger, yeah.
I was in high school, so I'm just like, you know, they're just giving her money because she's so pretty.
Well, yeah, and they kind of make it seem less
horrible.
Downplay it. They do. Yes, they definitely don't spell it out for you. They let you think what you would like to think about that. But she is given $50 to go to the powder room, so you can make of it what you would like. But then these men do tend to come and stalk her, and this is one of the guys. He's chasing her into her apartment, and she gets away from him. And the next thing that happens is George Peppard, whose name is Paul Varjak in the film, he shows up at this apartment. He also can't get into the apartment. Apparently, it's very hard for people to get into this apartment complex that live here because nobody has their key. It's all confusing. So he's buzzing her. I wonder sometimes about that scene, like, why does he continue to buzz her? Why doesn't he try to buzz one of the other occupants? I don't know. I always think that. But I mean, obviously, that wouldn't work well with the plot. But it just seems strange that you would just keep buzzing the same person over and over again. So she comes and she lets him in, and that's how they get introduced. And Paul Varjak, George Peppard, he plays the main character, the character that Truman Capote wanted to play. And George Peppard, not really great to act with. Kind of a method actor, but really, really difficult.
Right. Patricia
Neal
was getting the blunt to most of the bad behavior.
Yeah, and Patricia Neal also herself was a method actress, but she, it was said that previous to this film, she and George got along very well.
Right.
But they during this film, together. She just couldn't take him. He was just so difficult, and he was mentioned by many different people in production. I read many different things that he was very intense, was the word I kept saying. And he wouldn't let Patricia Neal play her character as it was supposed to be played. She was supposed to be this very dominant character, and he felt like that was infringing on his masculinity or something. And so he would, this is actually a quote from her, he wanted things as he wanted them. I dominated him a lot more in the script, and he didn't want to be seen in that condition. So, yeah, she said he seemed to want to be an old-time movie hunk.
The way it was described by the director and the producers, he saw it as if he were the star of the movie.
Yes. I think he thought he was the star. And I think he had no interest in listening to what the director's ideas were. I think he had his own ideas for the role, which is very common with method actors, but most of them can still manage to work with everybody else. And he made Audrey feel really insecure as well, not purposely, but just because he was so thorough and methodical about his acting that she felt like, oh, maybe her acting wasn't up to, because she always felt this way about herself. She was so down on herself, and she was so good at thing. She had an Academy Award, and George Peppard never had one.
Yeah. Speaking of thinking about other people that were almost in that role. Truman Capote, not really up for that role, but one in it. Tony Curtis.
And Steve McQueen.
Yes.
Can you imagine Steve McQueen? I would have not minded to see Steve McQueen in that role.
It's thought that Mel kind of put the kibosh on that.
That's what I heard. Mel did not want her to work with Tony Curtis.
When I found that out, I'm like, I wonder if, oh my gosh, I wonder how it would have been with Tony Curtis.
I wonder how it would have been with Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
Although I can't see Steve McQueen playing that vulnerable of a role either, to be honest. He's always kind of very masculine as well. Tony Curtis would do better with that.
He has the vulnerability. I saw it in Some Like It Hot. I know you're quite a fan of that movie, too.
Yeah, that's a great movie. So anyhow, she and George, they wind up meeting, and she has to run off to go to Sing Sing because she's passing these coded messages on for this mobster called Sally Tomato, of all things. But she's not aware she's passing, or at least she acts like she's not aware that she's passing on coded messages. I wonder that sometimes about that. Well, does she really know she is, or is she just doing this clueless bit on purpose?
I feel like Paul picked up on it right away. He's like, hey, you better be careful. Right. She's like, oh, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I don't think she was
clueless.
Aware.
Yeah. Like, so in a way, it's like her character is innocent and not innocent simultaneously. So it's an interesting character. She's supposed to be this cold-hearted call girl, but then you find out she isn't. She's more like this warm-hearted, innocent person. So it's a really interesting paradox in her character to me. I mean, I think Audrey played it really, really well, to be honest.
And really giving a woman a very multifaceted character to play in that time.
Yeah, I agree. That's very nice to see that. That's not all that common. So as she's going to get the taxi to go to see Sally Tomato, now Patricia Neal comes up, and her name cracks me up in this film. So her name in the film is actually Emily Eustace Phelanson, but she's referred to as 2E because she has the 2Es in her name. The entire film, she's called 2E. So as Audrey's starting to get in the cab, 2E comes out of the cab, Patricia Neal, and they said they had to dye her hair red so she wouldn't compete with the brunette for Audrey. I don't know why hair colors would be compete. I never understood that. There's the same thing with Marilyn. Nobody could have the same hair as blonde as Marilyn. And I thought, why?
They had their signature.
Yeah,
their
signature look. I don't think Audrey would have been like, whoa, no, nobody else can be brunette. I don't think that came from Audrey, but who knows? Maybe it did. So she gets introduced to 2E, Patricia Neal, and we find that Patricia Neal is kind of the sugar mama, I guess we could say, for Paul Varjak. The reason he's in this apartment is because she rented this apartment for him, and he's living there on her dime. And we find out he's a writer. And later on, Holly comes back, and she has another one of these creepy men in her apartment. He's causing this commotion, and she runs up the fire escape, and she sees 2E leaving, and she sees 2E leaving the money on the table for Paul. And she's like, oh, we're in the same line of work kind of here. So she comes in and she knocks on the window, and he's in bed, at least half naked. You can't see because he's wearing sheets, and she's in her robe, and she comes in and they talk and banter and they become friends. And she keeps calling him Fred because her brother's name is Fred. And I think it probably symbolizes her trust in him and her affection for him. Why is she calling him Fred and nobody else?
I think there was some resemblance. You do see a photograph later, and also maybe seeing him more as a peer since they are in a similar line of work.
Yeah, and also maybe just wanting to have her brother with her so much that she sort of substitutes him in her life as her brother. That's why she always calls him Fred and she never calls him by his proper name, except the one time they're in the library when she's got his book. That's the only time she calls him but every other time she calls him Fred, and she calls him Fred so much that other characters also call him
baby.
Fred. Yes. As a matter of fact, so they have this thing and they get in bed and they fall asleep together, but nothing happens. They're friends, blah, blah, blah. She invites him to this party. Now, this party scene is really interesting. First of all, I really enjoy the music. I'm not good at identifying different instruments that are being played, but I really love the instruments that Henry Mancini plays in these different scenes, like the party scene. I feel like there's a lot of horns and there's sort of like a light upbeat instruments in music, flutes or something. I don't really know.
It's definitely brass heavy in the party scene.
It's very jazzy. It's sort of like the jazzy music that I think that movies did a lot of in the late 60s, that I see in the late 60s and early 70s, that sort of jazzy sound in those kind of movies. But I love the scene. It's a very funny scene, first of all.
Oh, yes.
And we get introduced to, I think, one of the best characters in the film is the agent, mm-hmm. O.J. Berman, played by Martin Balsam, who we actually just talked about Martin Balsam. He was just in the Bedford Incident. So we had him a couple times now. And I really think he does a great job in this film. I love him in this film.
I am quite fond of him as well. And he's really the only... Besides, I feel like the name is like Vajuli. He's like goes by one name.
The Spanish guy. Yeah,
her
it's
later
like Villa
lover.
Villa Yonga. Villa
yeah,
Long.
Villa, I was really
Villa Yonga.
Yes. Those are really the only two name actors in that scene, but those are not extras in that scene. Edwards hired actors that were trying to make it because he really wanted to play up the comedy. And you being a fan of films of all decades can probably see there was some inspiration from slapstick silent film era in that scene.
That scene is quite funny, like when she's lighting that lady's hat on fire. It is a really funny scene. And also on top of actors, he also used some friends as well he threw in that scene as
It was choreographed by the same choreographer that he worked with in High Time. And she's actually seen in that scene arguing with the man that has the eye patch, who later lifts the eye patch. But that's her in the gold dress.
You know who I really like in that scene that has just a really, really, really small role is Dorothy Whitney as Mag Wildwood.
Yes.
Oh, she's so dynamic in the way she talks. I wish I could imitate. It's like, wow. How does she say it? But she's so.
Max.
Yes, she has this accent, this rusty tralla or whatever like that. Yeah, like an accent like that. But she's so good in that particular role, especially when she starts getting drunk and she's...
when she was really nervous to film, but they had a mattress to catch her.
Well,
but just the way she had
fall can you
with
imagine?
Her arms like that.
Can you imagine even with a mattress letting yourself fall that? Well, I know, I'd be afraid. I feel like you'd be scared. But yeah, let's talk about this fellow. Is it Villa Yonga? Mm-hmm. It's the two L's is like a Y, isn't it? Villa Yonga. Mm-hmm. This fellow wasn't a very established big actor or anything, but he was a member of the Spanish nobility. He was a marquis. This role works really well for him because he's very much acts like a nobleman because he was a nobleman. And another film I noticed that he was in is Juliet of the Spirits, which is a Federico Fellini film. I really like it as well, but he's kind of subdued. He doesn't have a lot of dynamicness to him. He has a nice appearance.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't really have a lot of presence, but he does definitely look like he's supposed to be this rich, fancy Portuguese political. Isn't he supposed to be political?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but he definitely has the bearing and all that of that. So you do get that. Mag brings this fellow. His name in the film is Jose, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
She brings this guy Jose and Rusty Trawler, who's this little...
He looks kind of like Drew Carey.
Yes, he does look like Drew Carey. Yes, he does. And so she brings these two guys. And at first, George thinks that she's fascinated by this Jose because he's very handsome. And then she's like, no, it's Rusty. And he's the ninth richest man.
Richest man under the age of 50.
Okay. She kind of sets her sights for them. And I think Paul is not very happy about it, but he doesn't really do anything at that point. You know, he's just kind of whatever. So after the party scene, she takes him to Sing Sing and introduces him to Sally Tomato.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then the next sort of thing that happens in the film is that Buddy Epstein shows up. And Buddy Epstein, another really good character in the film. And the way he shows up is that Patricia Neal comes up to the apartment to see Paul and she's all upset. Oh, there's a man stalking me and following me. He's been outside the last 2 days. And you look down and it's Buddy Epstein, right? And so Paul's like, I'm going to go sort this out. And he winds up doing all this thing and the guy is following him around.
Mm-hmm.
And he winds up sitting on, they go to Central Park, I think.
They do.
Yeah. And he's sitting on some bench or something. And Buddy Epstein comes in. He has this Cracker Jack box, which is significant in its own right. And then he announces that he's this fellow named Doc Golightly. And he's Holly Golightly's, first he asks, is he Holly's father, because he clearly has a
much
big age
older.
Difference. And then he's like, oh, no, I'm her husband. And he tells Paul that her name was Lula May and she was from Tulip, Texas, and the brother and all this stuff. And then what I thought was a little disturbing about this also was that he apparently married her when she was 14. And I was like, no, not good. But, you know.
But it seemed to me like she was trying.
Running
when he
away.
Found her, she was just with Fred.
Yep.
They had run away from whoever was caring for them last. So I feel like she married him in quotation marks just kind of to escape her last situation.
Yeah, to try to find like a protector, maybe even a father figure.
And I think she did respect how good he was with animals.
Too, oh, yeah.
Especially with Freddie.
Yeah, he's not a medical doctor, we should say. He's an animal doctor, which he says that in the film. He's a vet, apparently. A vet, not a term they use, I suppose, but he calls himself an animal doctor. And the scenes with him are really poignant. And another thing that I really like about those scenes with him is that they play Moon River almost exclusively for his scenes. So it makes it even more poignant. It's very touching, especially when she tells him he has to go back and he gets on the bus. They're really touching scenes, I think, with Buddy Epstein. And I think he did a really nice job. And of course, he then would rise to fame from the Beverly Hillbillies.
Right.
So, yeah, that was his big stuff.
And prior to World War II, he was in the musical number, like the musical Broadway medley of 1938.
Oh, yeah.
And then after the war was kind of more doing B-Western. So this was kind of his first opportunity to be in a bigger part.
Big film, yeah. He started out as being the Tin Man on The Wizard of Oz.
No. Oh,
but he had
right.
such a bad reaction to the makeup. He had a severe reaction to it. He had to be hospitalized. And they's like, oh, well, we can't bother with this. We're just finding somebody else. They just ditched him.
Oh, my gosh. I knew that there was an original. I didn't make the connection that was the same guy.
That was just so awful, the way they treated him. First of all, you put dangerous makeup on him and caused him to be hospitalized. And then you said, well, that's too bad.
Was it lead-based or something wild?
It might have been because none of that makeup was very safe. I mean, the witch's makeup burnt her, too. So it was not a very safe film. This was 1939. But then another thing I like is after the Moon River scenes with Doc, they go to the strip club. And then the music in the strip club, fantastic. Mm-hmm. I love that sort of burlesque sound that they have with the drums and the cymbals. Oh, it's so cool. And it's just such a cool scene. I really like it. And Audrey wants to go out and get drunk. So he takes her, she asks to go to the strip club. Somehow they wind up at the strip club and she gets really drunk and he takes her home. He takes her home, but then when they get home, doesn't she then announce that she's decided she's going to try to marry Rusty Trawler? Because one of the things Doc had mentioned when he left was that he was not going to support Fred when he came back from the army. Mm-hmm. So she feels like she has to now get a rich husband to help support Fred.
Yes, and Fred was coming back from the army in February.
Months,
It's now October.
Yeah, so he's due back shortly, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And she's... You know, you find throughout the entire film, she's obviously thinking about Fred throughout the whole thing because she references him all the time throughout the film. Mm-hmm. So it's clear that that's what's on her mind almost the whole film. Despite all this other stuff that she's doing, this sordid stuff and whatever, she's always thinking about her brother Fred, which I think is really nice.
And some of the sordid stuff may be because she's trying to
get money. Yeah, it's definitely why. She's not
doing
it.
Save money. Yeah. So she keeps saying how hard it is for her to save money.
Oh, and I should mention when they get the Cracker Jack box, Buddy Epstein hands the Cracker Jack box to Paul for him to have some Cracker Jacks. And he finds the prize. And when he opens the prize, it's a little ring. And he says, do you want this? And he said, no, you keep it. I read that they had to go through 200 Cracker Jack boxes before they could find one with a ring on. Apparently, the prize of that time was a whistle. So they had to keep going through all these Cracker Jack boxes. 200 boxes. All of them have whistles. And then finally, they were able to find one with a ring so they could use it. Although, why wouldn't you just put a ring in the crack? I don't know. Couldn't you seal it up again? I mean, whatever. I guess they wanted to be very realistic. Mm-hmm. Good for them. Okay, so then she gets drunk. She tells him that she's going to marry Rusty Trawler. They get into a humongous fight. And then the next day, he gets this check from a book that he's written. So he's all excited. He comes down. He apologizes to her. And of course, he also finds out that Rusty Trawler has coincidentally just gotten married. Mm-hmm. The very next day, they find this information out. So then they go off and they do all these things that they've never done before. And this is when they have that little scene where, well, first they go to the library.
Well, it started with having champagne before breakfast. He's like, oh, I don't think I've ever had champagne before breakfast. She's like, what a wonderful idea. We'll have a whole day doing things we've never done before.
Yeah. And they go to the public library and they go to check out his book. And that's a funny scene with the librarian there too, when he's signing the book and she's, you're defacing the property of the... And apparently this lady that was the librarian was also somebody that was a friend of Blake Edwards, not really necessarily an actress. She was a real estate agent.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
She played the part perfectly.
Yeah, she did a really nice job.
And now, then, correct me if I'm wrong, I always interpreted it that the story he sold, you see him in an earlier scene typing something, my friend, talking about how he met a very scared, very frightened girl. So I always thought that the money he got was because he wrote a story about Holly.
Yeah, that's true. They never really explain what he sold.
That was really the only thing we ever saw him write.
That is true. That is the only thing we ever saw him write. And he claimed in the beginning he was writing a novel that he had been writing for 2 years or something. Then Holly quizzed him as to, does he write every day? And he said yes. And then she said, well, there's no ribbon in this typewriter. So she kind of caught him in a lie there. So yeah, right. I don't know. Maybe he had, in the meantime, written a story about her and that's what he sold. They never really explain what he sold for the $50, but I think we can just believe.
Yes.
That makes us feel good. So then next they go to the library, then they leave the library, and then they go to this five and dime store and they're going to steal something. And again, the music in this is great, 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 great.
That's the musical equivalent of a tiptoe.
Yeah. And the sneaking. Again, I don't know what instruments they're using. It seems like a lot of low, deep sounding instruments, maybe tubas. My music knowledge is
I would
not
say
good.
Maybe some trombones.
Trombones, yeah. Well, you know more about music than I, but it has this very low and sneaky, this very sneaky sounding music, like when they're sneaking around with the mask. Henry Mancini, I'm so impressed with what he did with the music in here. I mean, he definitely deserved the Oscar for this. So they do all this stuff and then they wind up kissing and then you don't see it, but you are led to believe that they sleep together and they consummate their relationship. Now they're in a different level of relationship. They're not friends anymore. And then the next day, Paul, he assumes this, right? He has this idea in his head that they're in a relationship now. He tells Patricia, get lost, lady. Mm-hmm. Not in those words. He doesn't say that. I do like how he says, you're a very stylish girl, 2E. Let's end this stylishly. I thought that was a nice line. And I just think Patricia Neal throughout the film really does a great job in that role. I really like her in that role.
She is the epitome of class.
Yeah.
Speaking of great voices, Audrey obviously has a great voice, but Patricia Neal has a great voice.
Like a singing voice or just
no, speaking voice.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah, she does. And she's
Low.
You have to give her credit for versatility because she plays this very classy, upscale lady. She plays it perfectly. And she had just previously won an Oscar for her role in Hud, where she plays this very different kind of character. So she's a very versatile actor, also a method actor, but apparently not to the extreme of George Peppard. So he dismisses her. She goes away. But then, unfortunately, now Holly's vanished and he can't find her. He eventually does find her in the library of all places. And she's acting very weird. She's not responding to him. And she pretty much tells him, look, you don't own me. I don't want to be involved with you. She seems to have this character where if she feels like she's getting too close to somebody, she starts to feel trapped. So she pushes them away. And that's what she's doing with him. And he's really upset about it. It really hurts his feelings. And so she makes a decision that she's now going to marry this Jose.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently he's involved with her. And then we come to that scene that you and I talked about before when they're at her apartment and she gets a telegram and she reads it. And the next thing you know, George is coming up the stairs and she's screaming and throwing things around and destroying the entire apartment. And Jose's like, what's going on? I don't know what's going on. She's acting crazy, blah, blah, blah. And George is the one that's able to calm her down, get her in bed. And we find out that the telegram said that her brother Fred was killed. So it's a really sad scene, a really poignant scene.
It really hurts even more knowing how close he was to coming back home.
Yeah. Apparently he was not killed in action. He was killed taking a Jeep to some location, not at all in the field or anything. And oh, I wanted to make a note of the cat.
Yes, because that's a connection to another movie you showed this summer.
Oh, it is it?
I was assuming. Orangey was the same cat in The Incredibly Shrinking Man.
Well, it said that actually 9 cats were used in this film. One is called Orangey. He's the one, specifically, that's why I wanted to mention him.
Billing.
He's in that particular scene where she kind of flings the cat up into the door and he's like, wah! He's the one in that scene and he was a top animal actor. And he even won his second Patsy Award, which is the animal equivalent of the Oscars.
But yeah, you always have to have more than one. Even Wishbone had more than one dog actor.
Well, I think it's funny that there were 9 cats. 9 cats,
they're all
9
lives.
And Paul Barjack's book was called 9 Lives.
Oh, wow. So many connections.
Interesting tie-ins. And I think we're about as close to the end of the plot as we can get without doing spoilers, which we don't want to do. So do you have anything else you want to mention about this film?
More about the time period of this film, 1961.
Yes.
This was when the code was starting to finally be loosened a bit. Reason being, Americans were too comfortable at home watching their televisions. And I thought, what a parallel to right now, the 2020s, this decade. So many Americans are sitting at home watching their streaming services instead of going to the movie theater. Taylor Swift has helped with that, apparently. Yeah. But I just found that so interesting that they tried a lot of things in the 50s, like 3D, CinemaScope, but it was really getting films just a little bit more dirty and
more risque.
And Breakfast at Tiffany's was one of those.
Yeah, and it's not terribly.
No.
Yeah,
it's by today's standards.
Even the stripper doesn't doesn't reveal anything except her back and her shoulders.
Yeah, that scene. Did you ever watch A Woman in Paris or A Woman of Paris? Charlie Chaplin's film that he was not in, and that was a serious drama. They showed it as part of the Silent Film Festival this year. There's a party scene where a woman reveals herself, but it's all off camera, so you only see the reaction.
Oh, yeah.
So that kind of reminded me of that, because you just see Paul Fred completely distracted.
He's not
like,
paying attention.
Wait, what? What did you just say?
Yeah, Audrey's fascinated, and Paul's just bored almost. That seems like it would be the opposite.
I thought he was so engrossed that he missed what Holly was saying.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah, you might be right. But she was also very engrossed. She's sitting there putting her glasses down.
Do you
down.
Think she's extremely talented or just amusing?
Did she say? Do you think she's extremely well paid too?
Yeah.
I thought she said, did she played handsomely? Do you think she's paid handsomely? And then she says how she could do better because she would still keep her candy store, which is what she calls Sally Tomato. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, we forgot about when they get arrested. Her and Paul come into the room and they get arrested all of a sudden. Out of the blue, the police are there. And it turns out that Sally Tomato's being caught passing these messages, and she's in the middle because she's technically the one passing the messages, and she's sitting there giving almost this press conference.
Yes.
And telling people, he is a darling old man. And they're like, who's going to be your lawyer? And she says, well, Mr. O'Shaughnessy, who is the lawyer of Sally Tomato. And then she looks over, and in comes Mr. O'Shaughnessy, all handcuffed as well. And she's like, Mr. O'Shaughnessy. And he's like, shut up. It's just, I don't know. It's just, that's a really funny scene, too. I really like that scene. I think this film has so much humor. It's very funny and very cute and very touching. I feel like you get all the emotions in this particular film.
And very fashionable, too.
Yes. Audrey Hepburn was a style icon to begin with, but this film really puts her in the upper echelon specifically, and the music, amazing. It's really well done all around.
Yes, it's so rewatchable. And when you think about the iconic Hollywood leading ladies, each one, like I said earlier, has the film they're known for. I think this is one that really has stood the test of time. Marilyn had the 7-year itch. Everyone knows her, the white dress, the sewer grate. Oh, but how many people have actually seen it? I mean, you and I have seen it, but how many people have actually seen
it? Yeah, I don't think it's her most popular film by any stretch.
But it's the one she's known for.
Yeah, because it's literally because of her dress blowing up, not because of any of her acting or anything related to the film itself.
But I would say this one is still being watched today.
Oh, yeah.
Popular.
Again, the only thing that makes it not great is the bad performance by Mickey Rooney. But if we could just erase that part, this would be one of the greatest films.
Oh, there's so much technology that
I know. Can we just sort him out? Just take him out and replace him with a CGI Japanese person instead of him. That would be great. And even I watched this with the commentary from the actual producer.
Was it Shepard or Jura?
Shepard.
Okay.
And he did the actual commentary, and he said numerous times throughout the commentary how much he wished they didn't have Mickey Rooney in that role, and how much he had actually asked to not have him, and that Blake Edwards was the one that insisted. And I don't think Blake Edwards quite realized how offensive it was. And I don't even think Mickey Rooney at the time recognized. I think Mickey Rooney thought he was doing a comical bit. It's not funny. But I think in Mickey Rooney's mind, it was funny, because again, he's a product of more the 30s and the 40s, this vaudeville type thing. Mm-hmm. It's almost the equivalent to me in a blackface. It's so bad.
It's really, really bad. And both producers were like, please don't have Mickey Rooney. Can't we get a Japanese actor?
Yeah.
And Axelrod, too, was like, he's ruining the effing picture.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. That brings us to our star ratings.
Oh, yes.
So we always do a star rating, one being the worst, five being the best. So we let you go first since you're the guest.
So it's out of 5?
Yes, 1 to 5.
Okay. I actually already put it on Letterboxd. If you are on there, it's similar to Goodreads. You can put all your movies and rate them. I gave it 4. And it is because we had to deduct some points there for the offensiveness. But it gains points for Audrey's playing a role that kind of stretched her.
Yeah.
And she did it beautifully.
Yeah, a very against type role for Audrey. And she did a wonderful job. I have to give it a 3.5, and that is mainly because of Mickey Rooney. The music I love. The acting is really good. The cinematography is good. Not the best cinematography I've ever seen, but it's good. And like I said, my favorite parts are the score, the acting, but I can't give it a 4 just because of Mickey Rooney, honestly. It deserves better. If he wasn't in it, I would have a much higher score for it.
I think I just fell too much in love with Audrey Hepburn in that movie. I'm blinded.
You only gave it a 0.5 point more than me. And I'm notoriously low with my scores. I give everything a low. I mean, I gave Citizen Kane 4.5, so.
I still have to see that one.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it's a great film. Everybody should at least see the film once in their life. It's a very technical film. It's not a super entertaining film, is what I will say. But if you love cinematography and you love those technical aspects of the film, you will love Citizen Kane.
Okay, so that's the homework you're giving me. Can I give you homework?
Yes.
So I know because I talked to Sean, I listened to the Bride of Frankenstein episode, that horror is maybe not your favorite. But I know you're a fan of the look of film.
Yes.
And you said 1911 to 1970. So this was made in the 60s. Mario Bava, Blood and Black Lace, is the most beautiful horror film ever made. Technicolor that you could not even dream of. Beautiful women. I think this might turn you into a horror fan. I'm going to put
fan.
It out there.
That's strong. That's strong.
An appreciator.
Yes, that might be a better thing. I will say that I did really love The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and I didn't dislike The Bride of Frankenstein. I actually appreciated many things about that film. They had a lot of nice symbolism in there.
Bell jar people are my favorite part of that whole film.
That was beautifully shot. The cinematographer was excellent on that film, and the editor. But anyhow, we probably should get finished up here, but I want to thank you again, Mary Beth, for coming on. I really appreciate you being my guest today. It was really wonderful to chat with you about Audrey Hepburn. I'm sure we could chat for hours about her.
Oh my God, yes.
Anyhow, thank you again for coming. And for Wendy, for Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review, goodbye. Thank you for listening to our podcast today. Please don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. And please leave us a comment or a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Intro and outro music composed by Heidi Engel. Artwork by Tyler Birch. Produced and edited by Wendy Wittick. Recorded at PCTV Studios, Pittsburgh, PA. See you next time.